me. Her fingertip trails across the image. Then she turns my way with an intensity that bolts me to my chair. We mustn't let people find out, she says, her voice lowered. She glances toward the door, leans close, then adds in a whisper, They can never know about Arcadia. It's a moment before I can answer. My mind swirls. Have I ever heard her mention that word before? What? Grandma Judy, what's Arcadia? Psst! The sound is so sharp she spits a fine spray across the table. If they ever found out. They? They who? The doorknob rattles, and she sits back in her chair, folds her hands neatly one over the other. An eye flash silently instructs me to do the same. I pretend to relax, but my head is cluttered with possibilities. Everything from a Watergate-style cover-up involving my grandfather to some secret society of political wives acting as Cold War spies. What has my grandmother been involved in? A friendly attendant enters with coffee and cookies. At Magnolia Manor, residents not only have meals, they also have snacks and drinks in between. My grandmother jerks a secretive backhand toward my phone, her head turning to the server. What do you want? The attendant isn't flustered by the uncharacteristically gruff greeting.
Morning coffee, Mrs. Stafford.
Yes, of course.
Grandma Judy again covertly indicates that I should put the phone away.
We'll enjoy a cup, certainly.
I glance at the time. It's later than I thought. I'm supposed to join my father for a luncheon and ribbon cutting in Columbia.
A golden opportunity to be seen rubbing elbows in the home state, as Leslie put it.
Press will be there, as will the governor. With the recent rumbles about Washington insiders and career politicians, these local events matter. I get it, but what I really want to do is stay with Grandma Judy long enough to see if I can gain some clarity on this May Crandall issue and find out what Arcadia has to do with it. Maybe she's talking about a place? Arcadia, California? Arcadia, Florida? I really have to go, Grandma. I'm scheduled to accompany Daddy to a ribbon cutting.
Heavens, then I shouldn't be holding you up.
The attendant moves in and pours two cups of coffee anyway.
Just in case, she says.
You could take it to go,
my grandmother jokes. The coffee is in a china cup. I probably don't need any more this morning. I'll be bouncing off the walls. I just stopped by to ask you about May.
Psst.
A hiss and a raised finger stop me from finishing the name. I'm given the snake eye, as if I've just cursed in church. The attendant wisely gathers her cart and leaves the room. Grandma Judy whispers,
Be careful, Rill.
What? The intensity is once again startling. What's going on in that mind of hers? Rill. Is that a name?
Ears,
Grandma Judy points to hers,
are everywhere.
Just as quickly, her mood changes. She sighs, tips up the tiny china pitcher, and pours a dab into her coffee.
Cream?
I can't stay.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I wish you had time for a visit. It was lovely of you to pop in.
At this point, we've been chatting for at least 30 minutes. She's already forgotten. Arcadia, whatever it is, has disappeared into the mist. She gives me a smile as blank as a freshly washed blackboard. It's completely genuine. She's not sure who I am, but she's trying to be polite.
Come again when you don't have to rush off.
I will. I kiss her on the cheek and walk out of the room with no answers and even more questions. There's no way I can let this thing drop now. I need to find out what I'm dealing with here. I'll have to unearth some other source of information, and I know where I intend to start digging.
Chapter 8. Rill. The shadow of the big white house slides over the car, swallowing it whole. Tall, thick magnolia trees line the curb, making a leafy green wall that reminds me of Sleeping Beauty's castle. It hides us from the street, where kids play in yards and moms push prams along the sidewalks. There's a baby carriage on the front porch of this house. It's old, and a wheel is missing, so it leans. It'd likely dump the baby out if you put one in it. A little boy squats in one of the magnolia trees like a monkey. He's about lark size, maybe 5 or 6. He watches us drive in but doesn't smile, or wave, or move. When the car stops, he disappears into the leaves. A second later, I see him crawl from the tree and squeeze under a tall iron fence that circles the backyard of this house and the place beside it. The little building next door looks like it might have been a school or a church once. Some kids are playing on the teeter-totters and swings there, but the doors and windows are boarded shut, and there's hardly any paint on the wood. Brambles grow over the front porch, which makes me think of Sleeping Beauty again. Camellia stretches upward from the floorboard to see. "This the hospital?" She gives Miss Tan a look to let her know she don't believe it for a minute. My sister has rested up on the drive, and she's ready for another fight. Miss Tan turns her way and shifts Gabian, who's gone plumb asleep on her lap. His little arm flops down, chubby fingers gripping and ungripping. His lips move like he's blowing kisses in a dream. "You can't go to the hospital looking like that now, can you? Stinking of the river and infested with vermin. Mrs. Murphy will take care of you, and if you are very, very good, then we will see about the hospital." A hope spark tries to catch fire in me, but I can't find it much tinder. It snuffs out when Miss Tam looks my way. Fern crawls up my chest, her knees poking into my belly.
"I want Briny,"
she whisper whines.
"Hop to, time to go inside. You'll be just fine here," Miss Tam tells us. "If you're good." "Am I understood?"
"Yes'm," I try to answer for all of us. But Camellia's not giving up so easy.
"Where's Briny?"
She ain't happy about this whole thing, and she's working up to a blind mad fit over it. I can feel it like a storm blowing in.
"Hush, Camellia," I snap. "Do what she says."
Miss Tan smiles a little. "Very good. You see, all of this can be quite simple. Mrs. Murphy will take care of you." She waits for the driver to come around and open the car door. Then she climbs out first, taking my little brother and pulling Lark by the hand. Lark looks at me with wide eyes, but like always, she won't fight. She's quiet as a kitten in the hay.
"You next."
The woman wants me, and I scoot across, my knees knocking into the brown-eyed boy and girl on the floorboard. Fern wraps her arms around my neck so tight, I almost can't get a breath.
"You two now."
The kids who were in the car before us clamber out and onto the driveway.
"Now you."
Miss Tan's voice lowers when she looks at Camellia. She turns Gabian and Lark over to me, and stands right at the car door, her legs braced apart, her body blocking the way out. She's not a small woman. She towers over me, and she looks strong.
"Come on along, Camellia."
I'm begging her to be good, and she knows what I'm asking. So far, she hasn't moved an inch. She's got her hand around behind her back, and I'm afraid she's planning to try the other door. What use would there be in that? We don't know where we are, or how to get back to the river, or find the hospital. Our only hope is that if we're good, like Miss Tan says, we really will get to see Briny and Queenie. Or that Silas will tell them what happened and our folks will come find us. Camellia's shoulder jerks a little, and I hear the handle click. The door sticks, and Camellia's nose flares. She turns around to push, and Miss Tan sighs and leans inside. When she lumbers back out, she's dragging Camellia by her clothes.
That is enough of that. You will straighten up and behave yourself.
Camellia, stop!
I yell.
Camellia, no, no!
Fern's voice is like an echo. Gabian throws his head back and screams, the sound bouncing off the house and floating into the trees. Miss Tan twists her grip, so she's got a good hold on Camellia.
Do we understand one another?
Her round cheeks are red and sweaty. Her gray eyes bug out behind her glasses. When Camellia squeezes her lips tight, I think Miss Tan might swat that look right off her face. But she doesn't. Instead, she whispers something close to Camellia's ear, then stands over her.
We'll be just fine now, won't we?
Camellia's mouth still looks like she's sucked a lemon. The moment teeters like a bottle on the edge of the Arcadia's deck, waiting to topple down and be swept off in the river.
Won't we? Miss Tan repeats.
Camellia's dark eyes burn, but she nods.
Very well, then.
Miss Tan puts us in a line, and Camellia marches up the steps with the rest of us. From behind the iron fence, boys and girls of all sizes watch. Not a single one smiles. Inside, the big house smells. The curtains are pulled everywhere, and it's shadowy. There's a wide staircase in the front hall. Two boys sit on the top step. One of them reminds me of Silas, but bigger. Except his hair is red as fox fur. These boys don't look a thing like the kids in the yard, or the boy in the tree. They can't all be brothers and sisters. Who are they? How many are there? Do they live here? Are they all here to clean up so they can see their mamas and daddies at the hospital? What is this place? We're taken into a room where a woman waits behind a desk. She's small compared to Miss Tan. Her arms so thin the bones and veins show. Her nose pokes from her glasses, hooked like an owl's beak. It wrinkles when she looks at us. Then she smiles and stands and greets Miss Tan.
How are you today, Georgia?
Very well, thank you, Mrs. Murphy. It has been quite a productive morning, I dare say.
I can see that it has.
Stroking her fingers along the desk, Mrs. Murphy draws trails in the dust as she moves toward us. One side of her lip comes up, and an eye tooth flashes.
Good gracious! Where did you unearth these little waifs?
The kids cluster close to me, even the ones I don't know. I hang on to Fern on one hip, and Gabian on the other. My arms are starting to go numb, but I'm not letting go.
Aren't they a pitiful lot? Miss Tan says.
I do believe we've removed them just in time. Have you space for all of them? It would be the simplest thing. I expect to move some of them quite quickly.
Look at that hair, Mrs. Murphy comes closer,
and Miss Tan follows. Miss Tan's bulky body shuffles side to side as she walks. For the first time, I notice that she's got a bum leg.
Yes, quite something, isn't it? Four curly blondes, all from the same family, and that one.
She snorts and turns an eye on Camellia.
Oh, surely she isn't one of this batch. Mrs. Murphy looks at me. Is this your sister?
Yes'm, I say.
And her name is...
Camellia?
Quite a fancy name for such a common little thing. And all those silly freckles. Looks as though the stork dropped you into the wrong nest.
She isn't one to cooperate, Miss Tan warns. We've had trouble with her already. A little black sheep, in more ways than one.
Mrs. Murphy's eyes narrow.
Oh, my. Well, I do expect good behavior in this house. Those who fail to meet my expectations will not be allowed to keep company above stairs with the rest of the children.
She runs her tongue along her teeth. My skin turns cold. Fern and Gabian wrap their arms tighter around my neck. It's clear enough what Mrs. Murphy means. If Camellia makes her mad, they'll take her away and put her someplace else. Camellia nods, but I can tell she don't mean it a bit. These other two with the dirt blonde hair were found along the way. Miss Tan gathers the boy and girl who rode on the floor with Camellia. Both have long, straight, straw-brown hair and big brown eyes. The way the little boy is hanging on to the girl, I'm sure she's his big sister. More river rats, of course, although the camp down there was nearly empty. They must have gotten word somehow. Such darling faces. Yes, truly. These with the curls are almost angelic. They'll be in great demand, I predict. Mrs. Murphy pulls away. But good gracious, they stink of the river. I can't have that in my house, certainly. They'll have to stay outside until bath time. Don't let them out until you're certain they fully understand the rules here. Miss Tan drops a hand on Camellia's shoulder, and Camellia's head twitches so that I can tell the woman's fingers are digging in hard. This one is a runner. She tried to bolt from the car, of all things. Those cows along the river bottom do know how to produce them, but not how to teach them to behave. This batch will need some work. Of course. Don't they all? Mrs. Murphy nods. She focuses on me again. And your name is?
Real. Real Foss?
I try not to say anything more, but it spills out. I can't make sense of what they're talking about. And my heart is pounding. My knees tremble under the weight of my baby brother and sister. But that's not the only reason. I'm scared to death. Miss Tan plans to leave us here? For how long?
When can we go see our mama and daddy? They're at the hospital. Mama had a baby and...
Hush! Mrs. Murphy says. First things first. You will take the children into the hallway and sit them on the floor along the stairwell wall, smallest to largest. Wait there, and I'll expect no noise and no shenanigans. Understood?
But...
Miss Tan lays a hand on my shoulder this time. Her fingers squeeze around the bone. I do not expect to have trouble from you. Surely you are smarter than your sister. A pain shoots down my arm and I feel Gabian slipping.
Yes'm. Yes, ma'am.
She lets go of me. I hike Gabby up again. I want to rub my shoulder, but I don't. And Rill, what sort of name is that?
It's from the river. My daddy gave it to me. He says it sounds pretty as a song.
We'll call you something proper. A real name for a real girl.
May will do. May Weathers. But I'm
May. She shoos me out the door, the other kids dragging along with me. Camellia gets warned again not to do anything except sit quiet in the hallway. The little ones whine and whimper like puppies as I try to skin them off and set them down. Up the stairs, the two boys are gone. Somewhere outside, kids play Red Rover. I know that game from the schools we've gone to. When it's the school year, Queenie and Briny usually try to tie up someplace near a river town, so Camellia and me, and now Lark, can go. The rest of the time we read books,
and Brownie teaches us arithmetic. He can make a cipher out of almost anything. Camellia's a whiz at numbers. Even Fern knows her alphabet already, and she's still too young for school. Next fall, Lark will start the first grade. Lark looks up at me now, with her big mouse eyes, and a sick feeling bubbles in me like a black water eddy. It's got no place to go. It just spins round and round in circles.
Are they taking us to jail?
The little girl, the one whose name I don't even know, whispers. No, of course not, I say. They don't put little kids in jail. Do they? Camellia's eyes slant toward the front door. She's wondering whether she can light out of here and get away with it. Don't, I spit under my breath. Mrs. Murphy told us not to make noise. The better we are, the more chance they'll take us where we want to go, I figure. We need to stay together. Brownie's gonna come get us soon's he knows we're not on the Arcadia. Soon Silas tells him what happened. We've gotta be all in one place when he shows up. You hear me? I sound like Queenie when there's breaking ice on the water, and she won't let us hang over the rail in case a floe might hit the boat and shake us off into the river. Times like that, she wants us to know she means it when she says no. She don't get that way too often. Everybody nods but Camellia. Even the other little girl and boy nod. Amelia? Mm-hmm. She gives in and pulls her knees up and crosses her arms and sticks her face in the middle, letting her head bump hard enough to make sure we know she ain't happy about it. I ask the other kids' names, and neither one will say a word. Big tears roll down the little boy's cheeks, and his sister hugs him close. A bird flies into the front door glass and hits with a thud, and all of us jump. I stretch to see if it got up and flew off okay. It's a pretty little red bird. Maybe he's the one we heard by the river, and he followed us here. Now he staggers around, his feathers glittery bright in the long, lazy afternoon sun. I wish I could scoop him up before a cat can get him. We saw at least three in the bushes on the way in, but I'm afraid to. Miss Tan will think I'm trying to run. Lark gets up on her knees to see, her lip trembling. He'll be all right, I whisper. Sit down, be good. She does like she's told. The bird wobbles off toward the steps, so that I have to crawl away from the wall a little to see him. Fly, I think. Hurry up. Fly off before they get you. But he just stays there, his beak hanging open, his whole body panting. Fly away. Go on home. I keep watch. If a cat comes, maybe I can scare it off through the window. Words drift from under the door across the hall. I stand up real careful, tiptoe closer. I catch bits and pieces of what Miss Tan and Mrs. Murphy are saying, but none of it makes any sense. Surrender papers right at the hospital on the five siblings. Simple and straightforward. The easiest way to sever ties. The most difficult thing was finding the exact location of their shanty boat, actually. It was moored by itself across from Mud Island, the police tell me. The little freckle-faced one tried to swim out through the loo. That's more than just the river you caught a whiff of. Laughter twitters, but it's sharp like a raven's call. And the other two. Found them picking flowers near a hive of shantyboat vermin. We'll have their papers issued soon enough. Certainly it won't be any trouble. They seem quite mild-mannered, too. Sherry and Stevie. Those should do for names. Best to begin retraining them to them immediately. They are darling, aren't they? And young. They might not stay long. We've a viewing party planned next month. I'll expect them to be ready. Oh, they will be,
May, Iris, Bonnie, Beth, and Robbie for the other five, I think. Weathers should do for the last name. May Weathers, Iris Weathers, Bonnie Weathers. It has a ring to it.
Laughter comes again. It rises high and loud so that it pushes me back from the door. The last words I hear are Mrs. Murphy's.
I'll see to it. You can rest assured that they'll be properly prepared.
By the time they come out, I've scooted into my place and checked that everyone is lined real neat along the wall. Even Camellia picks up her head and sits Indian style the way we do in school. We wait, still as statues, while Mrs. Murphy walks Miss Tan to the door. Only our eyes turn to watch them talk on the porch. The little red bird has hopped to the stairs, but he just sits there helpless. Neither one of them notices.
Fly away.
I think of Queenie's red hat.
Fly all the way to Queenie and tell her where to find us. Fly!
Miss Tan limps a few steps, almost hitting the bird. My breath turns solid and Lark gasps. Then Miss Tan stops to say something else. When she starts off again, the red bird finally flies away.
He'll let Briny know where we are.
Mrs. Murphy comes back inside, but she's not smiling. She goes into the room across the hall and closes the door. We sit and wait. Camellia buries her face again. Fern lays on my shoulder. The little girl, Sherry, Miss Tan called her, holds her baby brother's hand.
I'm hungry,
he whispers.
I'm hungry,
Gabian echoes, way too loud.
Shh.
His hair feels soft under my hand as I rub his head.
We have to be quiet, like hide and seek, like a game.
He clamps his mouth and tries his best. Being only two, he's always left out of our let's pretend games on the Arcadia. So he's happy to be part of it this time. I wish this was a good game. I wish I knew the rules and what we get if we win. Right now, all we can do is sit and wait for whatever happens next. We sit and sit and sit. It seems like forever before Mrs. Murphy comes out. I'm hungry too, but I can tell by her face we'd best not ask. She stands over us with her fists poked into her sides, her hip bones sticking out under her flowered black dress.
Seven more, she says, frowning and looking up the stairs.
A breath comes out and sinks like fog. It smells bad.
Well, there isn't any choice about it. What with your parents unable to care for you? Where's Briny? Where's Queenie? Camellia blurts out. You will be silent.
Mrs. Murphy teeters on her feet as she moves down the line of us. And now I know what I smelled when she came out the door. Whiskey. I've been around enough pool halls to recognize it. Mrs. Murphy stabs a finger toward Camellia.
You are the reason everyone must sit here rather than going outside to play.
She stomps off down the hall, her steps drawing a crooked line. We sit. The little ones finally sleep, and Gabian falls flat out on the floor. A few other kids pass by, older and younger, boys and girls. Most wear clothes that are too big or too small. Not a single one looks our way. They walk through like they don't notice we're there. Women in white dresses with white aprons move up and down the hall in a hurry. They don't see us either. I wrap my fingers around my ankles and squeeze hard to make sure I'm still there. I almost think I've turned into the Invisible Man, like Mr. H.G. Wells wrote about. Briny loves that story. He's read it to us a lot, and Camellia and me play it with the kids in the river camps. Nobody can see the Invisible Man.
I close my eyes and pretend a while. Fern needs to potty, and before I can figure out what to do about it, she wets herself. A dark-haired woman in a white uniform walks by and spots the mess running across the floor. She grabs Fern up by the arm. We will have none of that here. You'll use the bathroom properly. She pulls a sack towel from her apron and throws it over the mess. Clean that up, she tells me. Mrs. Murphy will have a fit. She takes Fern with her, and I do what she says. When Fern comes back, her drawers and dress have been washed out, and she's wearing them wet. The lady tells the rest of us we can go to the bathroom too, but to hurry up about it, and then sit down by the stairs again. We haven't been back in our places long before someone blows a whistle outside. I hear kids clamoring around. Lots of them. They don't talk, but their footsteps echo beyond the door at the end of the hall. They're in there a while, and then there's a racket, like they're hurrying upstairs, but not the stairs next to us. Overhead, the boards creak and groan the way the gunnels and planking do on the Arcadia. It's a home sound, and I close my eyes to listen and pretend I can wish us back aboard our safe little boat. My wish dries up pretty quick. A woman in a white dress stops by and says, "Come this way." We climb to our feet to follow. Camelia goes first, and we keep the little kids between us, even Sherry and Stevie. The lady takes us through the door at the end of the hall, and everything looks a lot different back there. It's plain and old. Strips of paper and cheesecloth hang off the wall. There's a kitchen to one side, where two colored women are busy with a kettle on the stove. I hope we'll get to eat soon. My stomach feels like it shrunk to the size of a peanut. Even thinking that makes me hungry for peanuts. A big staircase rises off to the other side of the kitchen. Most of the paint's rubbed off, like it's been walked on a lot. Half the bars are missing from the railing. A couple loose ones hang out like the leftover teeth in old Zed's smile. The woman in the white uniform takes us upstairs and stands us along a hallway wall. Other kids form lines nearby, and I hear water running in a tub someplace. "No talking," the woman says. "You will quietly wait here until it's your turn for the bath. You will take off your clothing now and fold it neatly in a pile at your feet. All of it." Blood prickles in my skin, hot and sticky. And I look around and see that all the other kids, big and small, are already doing what we've just been told to do.
Chapter 9. Avery. May Crandall. Are you sure that name isn't familiar? I'm sitting in the limo with my mother and father, en route to the ribbon-cutting ceremony in Columbia. She's the one who found my bracelet at the nursing home yesterday. I say found because it sounds better than lifted it right from my wrist. The Greer design with the garnet dragonflies? The one Grandma Judy gave me. I think this woman recognized it. Your grandmother wore that bracelet frequently. Anyone who'd seen her in it certainly might remember it. It's quite unique. Mom searches her memory banks, her perfectly lined lips compressing. No, I really don't recall that name. Perhaps she's one of the Asheville Crandalls? I dated a boy from that family when I was young. Before your father, of course. Did you ask who her people are? For Honeybee, as with all well-bred Southern women of her generation, this is a natural question upon meeting. Wonderful to know you. Isn't this a lovely day? Now, tell me, who are your people? I didn't think to ask. Honestly, Avery, what are we going to do with you? Send me to the woodshed? My father chuckles, looking up from a briefcase filled with documents he's been reading.
Now, honeybee, I have been keeping her busy, and nobody could file away all those details the way you do.
Mom swats at him playfully.
Oh, hush.
He catches her hand and kisses it, and I'm pinned in the middle. I feel 13 years old.
Ew! PDA, y'all!
Since coming home, I've readopted words like y'all, which I had expunged from my vocabulary up north. They're good words, I've now decided. Like the humble boiled peanut. They serve perfectly in many situations.
Do you recall a May Crandall Wells? A friend of your mother's?
Honeybee retracts our conversation.
I don't think so.
Dad reaches up to scratch his head, then remembers that he's been amply hairsprayed. Outdoor occasions require extra preparation. Nothing worse than ending up in the newspaper looking like alfalfa. Leslie made sure I pulled my hair back. Honeybee and I match, actually. It's French twist day. Arcadia, I blurt out, just to see if the word draws a reaction. Was that one of Grandma Judy's clubs? Or maybe a bridge circle? Or did she know someone who lived in Arcadia? Neither my mother nor my father seems to have any unusual reaction to the word.
Arcadia, Florida?
Mom wants to know. I'm not sure. It came up in the conversation about her bridge groups. I don't tell her that the way Grandma Judy said it left me uneasy.
How could I find out more?
You're awfully concerned about this.
I almost pull out my phone to show her the photo. Almost. My hand stops halfway to my purse, and I smooth my skirt instead. The ember of a new worry is clearly visible in my mother's face. She doesn't need one more thing to stress about. If I show her the photo, she'll be certain a nefarious scheme is being perpetrated, and May Crandall wants something from us. My mother is a professional worrier.
I'm not really concerned, Mama. I was just curious. The woman seemed so lonely.
That's sweet of you, but Grandma Judy wouldn't be much company for her, even if they did know one another. I've just had to ask the Monday girls not to visit Magnolia Manor anymore. Too many old friends stopping by just frustrates your grandmother. She's embarrassed that she can't place names and faces. It's harder when it's not family. She worries that people are talking about her.
I know.
Maybe I should let this go. But the question nags me. It whispers and pesters and teases. It will not leave me alone all afternoon. We chat, we schmooze, we clap when my father cuts the ribbon. We spend time in the VIP lounge at the local country club, rubbing elbows with the governor and talking with corporate higher-ups. I'm even able to offer some free legal advice on the battle over natural gas fracking and ongoing legislation that could throw the doors wide open to it in neighboring North Carolina. Economy versus environment. So often it comes down to those two heavyweights duking it out in the ring of public opinion and, of course, upcoming legislation. Even as I'm discussing the cost-benefit questions, which I honestly do care about passionately, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking of the cell phone in my purse and Grandma Judy's reaction to the photo. I know she recognized the woman. Queen. Or Queenie. It's not a coincidence. It can't be. Arcadia. Arcadia... what? In the car on our way back to my father's Aiken office, I offer up a few innocent-sounding excuses to slip away from my parents for a while, errands and whatnot. The truth is that I'm going to see May Crandall again. If there is something going on here, I'm better off knowing about it. Then I can decide what needs to be done. Daddy actually seems a little disappointed that we're parting ways.
He has a strategy meeting with his staff before finally going home for supper. He was hoping I'd sit in.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Wells. Avery is allowed a personal life,
Mom interjects.
She has a handsome young fiancé to keep up with, remember?
Her slim shoulders rise, and she offers me a conspiratorial smile.
And a wedding to plan. They can't plan if they never talk.
The end of the sentence rises, sing-song with anticipation. She pats my knee and leans close. A meaningful look flashes my way.
Let's get this show on the road, it says.
She busies herself with her purse, lets a moment pass, and pretends to be casually switching topics. The gardener brought in some new form of mulch the other day, for the azaleas, on a recommendation from Bitsy's landscaper. They put it out last fall, and their azaleas were twice as thick as ours. Next spring, the gardens at Drayden Hill will be the envy of, well, everyone. Around the end of March. It should be just heavenly. The phrase, perfect for a wedding, hangs unsaid in the air. When we announced our engagement, Elliot made Bitsy and Honeybee promise they wouldn't sweep in and hijack the decision-making process. It's killing them, really. They'd have this thing all sewn up if we'd just get out of the way. But we're determined to make plans in our own time, in the way we think is best. Right now, my father and Honeybee should be focusing 100% on Dad's health, not worrying about wedding arrangements. You can't tell Honeybee that, though. I pretend not to get the drift. I think Jason could grow roses in the desert. Jason has managed the gardens at Drayden Hill since long before I left for college. He'd be thrilled to have the chance to show them off. But Elliot will never go for a wedding idea that originated with the moms. Elliot loves his mother, but as an only child, he's exhausted by her constant focus on arranging his life. One thing at a time, I tell myself. Daddy, cancer, politics. Those are the big three right now. We pull up in front of the office. The driver opens the door for us, and I slip out, glad that I'm free. One last thinly veiled hint follows me out the door. Tell Elliot to thank his mother for the suggestion about the azaleas. I will, I promise, then hurry off to my car, where I do call Elliot. He doesn't pick up. Chances are he's in a meeting, even though it's after 5. His financial clients are international, so demands come in around the clock. I leave a quick message about the azaleas. He'll get a laugh out of that, and he often needs it at the end of a high-stress day. A block down the road, I get a call from my middle sister, Allison.
Hey, Allie, what's up?
I say. Allison laughs, but she sounds frazzled. The triplets are fussing in the background.
Is there any way at all you could pick up Courtney from dance class? The boys are sick, and we've been through 3 sets of clothes today already, and, yeah, we're naked again. All 4 of us. Court's probably standing outside the dance studio wondering where in the world I am.
I make a quick U-turn toward Miss Hannah's, where I was a ballet and pageant class failure back in the day. Fortunately, Court has real talent. At her spring recital, she was amazing.
Sure, of course I'll do it. I'm not even very far away. I can be there to get her in 10.
Allison answers with a long sigh of relief.
Thank you. You're a lifesaver. Today, you're my favorite sister.
It's been a running joke since childhood, the question of who was Allison's favorite. As the middle kid, she had her pick. Missy was older and more interesting, but I was younger and could be bossed around. I laugh softly. Well, that's totally worth an extra trip across town.
And please don't tell Mama the boys are sick.
She'll come over here, and I don't want to take any chances on Daddy being exposed to whatever this bug is. Drop Courtney off at Shelley's house. I'll text the address to you. I already called Shelley's mom. They're fine with Court spending the night. Okay, will do.
Of the three of us, Allison is the most akin to Honeybee. She operates like a 4-star general. But since the boys came along, she's been overpowered by an invading army.
I'm almost at the studio. I'll text you once I've rescued your daughter.
We hang up, and a few minutes later, I'm pulling up to Miss Hannah's. Courtney is standing out front. She brightens when she sees that she hasn't been abandoned.
Hey, Aunt Aves, she says as she slides into the car.
Hey, yourself.
Mom, forget me again.
She rolls her eyes and lets her head sag to one side, a motion that makes her seem way more than 10 years old.
No, I was just lonesome for you.
I thought we could hang out, go to the park, slide down the slide, play in the play fort, that kind of thing.
Okay, seriously, Aunt Aves?
It bothers me that she's so quick to reject the idea. She's too grown up for her own good. Wasn't it just yesterday that she was tugging my pants leg and begging me to climb trees with her at Drayden Hill? All right, your mom did call me to pick you up, but only because the boys are sick. I'm supposed to take you to Shelley's house. Her face lights up, and she straightens in the passenger seat.
Oh, awesome!
I give her the stink eye, and she adds,
Not about the boys being sick, I mean.
I offer an ice cream stop, our favorite activity once upon a time, but she tells me she's not hungry. She only has eyes for Shelley's house, so I turn on the GPS and strike out in that direction. She whips out her cell phone to text Shelley, and my thoughts switch tracks. Arcadia and May Crandall overshadow the pangs of watching my niece rush headlong toward teenagerhood. What will May's response be when I ask her about that word, Arcadia? It's looking less likely that I'll find out today. By the time I drop Courtney off, it'll be supper hour at the nursing home. The staff will be busy, and so will May. I turn off the main road and wind through tree-clad streets lined with stately turn-of-the-century homes surrounded by perfectly manicured lawns and gardens. We've gone quite a few blocks before I realize why the trip to Shelley's house has such a familiar feel to it. Grandma Judy's home on Lanyap is not far away.
Hey, Court, want to run by Grandma Judy's house with me before I drop you at Shelley's?
I don't like the idea of going alone, but it has just occurred to me that there might be some answers to be found among Grandma Judy's belongings. Courtney lowers the phone, giving me a bemused look.
It's kind of creepy, Aunt Aves. Nobody's there, but all Grandma Judy's stuff is still around.
Her bottom lip pouts outward. Big blue eyes regard me earnestly. It's hard for the kids to accept the rapid change in Grandma Judy. This is their first real brush with mortality.
I'll go with you if you really need me to.
No, that's all right. I continue past the turnoff. There's no reason to involve Courtney. I'll run over to Lanyap after I drop Court at her friend's. She's clearly relieved.
Okay. Thanks for picking me up today, Aunt Aves.
Anytime, kiddo. A few minutes later, she's trotting up the driveway to Shelley's house, and I'm bound for Lanyap Street and the past. Blunt force grief strikes me as I pull into the drive and step from the car. Everywhere I look, there's a memory. The roses I helped my grandmother tend, the willow tree where I played house with the little girl from down the street, the Cinderella's castle bay window upstairs, the yawning porch that served as a backdrop for prom photos, the water garden where the multicolored koi bobbed for cracker crumbs. I can almost feel my grandmother on the Charleston-style piazza along the side of the house.
climbing the stairs. I half expect her to be there. It's painful to realize that she's not. I'll never again come to this place and be greeted by my grandmother. In the backyard, the greenhouse is stale and dusty smelling. The moist, earthy scents are gone. The shelves and pots have been removed, too. No doubt my mother gave them to someone who could use them. The hidden key is right where it has always been. It catches a beam of late afternoon light as I remove a loose brick along the foundation. From there, it's easy enough to slip inside and turn off the alarm. After that, I stand in the living room thinking, what next? The floorboards crackle beneath me, and I jump, even though it's an old, familiar sound. Courtney was right. The house seems vacant and spooky. No longer the second home it has always been. From the age of 13 on, I stayed here during the school year whenever my parents were in D.C., so I could attend classes in Aiken with my friends. Now, I feel like a sneak thief. This is silly anyway. You don't even know what you're looking for. Photos, maybe? Is the woman on May Crandall's nightstand in any of the old albums? Grandma Judy has always been the family historian, the keeper of the Stafford lineage, the one who tirelessly pecks out labels on her old manual typewriter and attaches them to things. There isn't a stick of furniture, a painting, a piece of artwork, or a photo in this house that isn't carefully marked with its origins and previous owners. Her personal items, any that matter, are similarly stored. The dragonfly bracelet came to me in a well-worn box with a yellowed note taped to the bottom.
July 1966. A gift. Moonstones for first photographs sent back from the moon by American Exploratory Spacecraft Surveyor. Garnets for love. Dragonflies for water. Sapphires and onyx for remembrance. Custom by Greer Designs. Damon Greer, designer.
Beneath that, she'd added,
for Avery, because you are the one to dream new dreams and blaze new trails. May the dragonflies take you to places beyond your imaginings. Grandma Judy.
It's strange, I now realize, that she didn't say whom the gift was from. I wonder if I can find that information in her appointment books. Never a week passed that she didn't carefully document the details of her days, keeping track of everyone she saw, what she wore, what was served at meals. If she and May Crandall were friends or shared a bridge circle, May's name will probably be there.
Someday you'll read these and know all my secrets, she told me once when I asked her why she was so meticulous about writing everything down.
The comment seems like permission now, but as I pass through the shadowy house, guilt niggles at me. It's not as though my grandmother has passed away. She's still here. What I'm doing amounts to snooping, yet I can't get past the feeling that she wants me to understand something, that this is important, somehow. For both of us. In her little office off the library, her last appointment book still sits on the desk. The page is open to the day she disappeared for 8 hours and ended up lost and confused at the former shopping mall. A Thursday. The handwriting is barely legible. It trembles and runs downhill. It looks nothing like my grandmother's lovely, curving script. Trent Turner, Edisto, is the only notation for that day. Edisto? Is that what happened when she disappeared? Somehow, she thought she was going to the cottage on Edisto Island to meet someone? Maybe she had a dream overnight and woke up believing it was real? Perhaps she was reliving some event from the past? Who is Trent Turner? I leaf through more pages. There's no mention of May Crandall among Grandma Judy's social engagements over the past months. Yet somehow, May gave me the impression they'd seen each other recently. The farther back I go, the clearer the handwriting becomes. I feel myself sinking into the familiar routines around which I once shadowed my grandmother. Events for the Federation Women's Club, the Library Board, the DAR, the Garden Club in the spring. It's painful to realize that 7 months ago, before her rapid downward spiral, she was still functioning reasonably well, still keeping up her social calendar, though a friend or two had mentioned to my parents that Judy has been having some lapses. I leaf through more pages, wondering, remembering, thinking about this watershed year. Life can turn on a dime. The appointment book reinforces my new awareness of this. We plan our days, but we don't control them. My grandmother's January notes begin with a single line scrawled haphazardly in the margin just before New Year's Day. Edisto and Trent Turner, she'd written again. There's a phone number jotted underneath. Maybe she was talking to someone about having work done on the cottage? That's hard to imagine. My dad's personal secretary has been handling Grandma Judy's affairs since my grandfather died 7 years ago. If there were any arrangements to be made, she would have taken care of them. There's one way to find out, I guess. I grab my cell and dial the number. The phone rings once, twice. I start wondering what I'm going to say if someone answers. I'm not sure why I'm calling. I found your name in an old notebook at my grandmother's house and what? A machine picks up.
Turner Real Estate. This is Trent. There's no one here to answer the phone right now, but if you'll leave a message.
Real estate? I'm gobsmacked. Was Grandma Judy thinking about selling the Edisto place? That's hard to fathom. The cottage has been in her family since before she married my grandfather. She loves it. My parents would have told me if we were letting go of the place. There must be another explanation. But since I have no way of knowing, I return to my browsing. In the closet, I find the rest of her appointment books stored in a well-worn barrister bookcase, right where they've always been. They're neatly arranged in order from the year she married my grandfather to the present. Just for fun, I take out the oldest one. The milky leather cover is dry and crazed with brown cracks, so that it looks like a piece of antique china. Inside, the handwriting is loopy and girlish. Notations about sorority parties, college exams, bridal showers, china patterns, and date nights with my grandfather fill the pages. In one of the margins, she has practiced signing her soon-to-be married name, the flourishes on the letters testifying to the giddiness of first love. Visited Harold's parents at Drayden Hill, one entry says. Horseback riding. Took a few fences. Harold said not to tell his mother. She wants us in one piece for the wedding. I have found my prince. Not the slightest bit of doubt. Emotion gathers in my throat. It's bittersweet. Not the slightest bit of doubt. Did she really feel that way? Did she really just know it was right when she met my grandfather? Should Elliot and I have experienced some sort of lightning bolt moment, rather than the relaxed drift from childhood adventures to adult friendship to dating to engagement because, after 6 years of dating, it seems like it's time? Is there something wrong with us because we haven't?